All right, this is Roberto. You are back with another Steambox podcast at Highlander Charter. I'm with my Highlander Steampunks. Highlander Steampunks, please say what's up.
What's up?
All right, cool. Today we have Tony Pasitti, author of My Best Friend is a Wookiee. I'm sorry that I just leaned forward to the paper to read it off of the paper because I read the book before. I just passed it off to Quinn. One boy's journey to find his place in the galaxy. Tony Pasitti is with us here today. Tony, hello.
How are you?
I am great. I'm looking forward to this conversation. The world is on fire right now, and I just can't wait to talk about Star Wars. My man Quinn, we have a young aspiring author with us in the group. My man Quinn, do you want to start us off with an opening question?
Sure, yeah. So I really enjoyed your book.
Oh, thank you very much.
Yeah. I just wanted to ask you, what was the biggest trouble growing up for you with writing? How did you get through your biggest trouble?
My trouble with writing or sort of like troubles as a kid,
did you combat it with your writing, or when did you start writing? Sorry.
I'm getting a lot from that. Was writing therapeutic?
Yeah.
Sure, yeah.
What kind of challenges did you have as a child? As probably like we are like nerdy children, right? Like, and forgive the presumption. What kind of challenges did you have becoming an author?
Yeah, well, I mean, when I was a kid, I was always very imaginative, always very much in my head. Sort of discovering writing came later, but I was always sort of coming up with stories on my own. When I was 7 or so, my family moved to a new town, so it was kind of a hard reset. I was a bit of an introvert, so it was tough to make new friends. And that kind of stuck with me for a little while. But the Star Wars was kind of the thing where I found my first, few real friends was through this mutual appreciation. And it's tough to think that this was the case, but when I was, a little kid in the early 90s, this was, 15 years or so after, or not 15, 10 years or so after Return of the Jedi had come out. Yeah. There was no, there were 3 Star Wars movies, no new ones on the horizon. It wasn't as popular or as cool as it was in the late 70s and early 80s. It was kind of this small thing that it felt like only nerdy kids were into. No one was talking about it. And then when they re-released them later in the 90s, and then when the prequels came out, then it all ramped up again. So it felt like this little kind of secret thing, and that's how me and my first handful of friends sort of found each other.
Can you imagine a world, because right now, like they put out the Han Solo movie, right? And when the Han Solo movie came out, people went like, oh, like another Star Wars movie. Like there's Star Wars fatigue. Like we grew up like wishing there was a new Star Wars movie. So much so that they gave us the same Star Wars movies with one new weird little alien in it. And we were like, yes, I will spend my money on that again. And now y'all get like a story based on Han Solo and you're like, another Star Wars movie? Like, what?
Do you remember the ad when they released when they re-released the original trilogy, there was this commercial. And it had a little tiny, it was a big black screen with a little tiny TV with scenes from Star Wars. And the music's very turned down and playing far away. And the guy's like, for a generation, you've only seen it on TV. And then the X-Wing flies out of the TV and it's in widescreen.
Yeah,
and we're like, we get to see it in the theater.
Yeah.
It was crazy. And now, again, like we got one a year for 5 years. That's insane.
So when you made this book, what kind of criticism did you receive? Any positive, any negative? Pretty sure those both.
Challenges and then criticism.
Sure. Challenges is I was, not previously a published author. I had done some small independent things. I had sort of through weird connections and friends of friends found this guy in Texas who was self-publishing comic books. So I wrote a couple of short scripts for that. Found some online things. I had done some writing in college for the school newspaper, and I wrote for a website that was based out of the New Bedford Standard Times. It was sort of like their online version of what used to be the Providence Phoenix, which was like an alternative weekly newspaper. So that was a big challenge. I wasn't really anybody. I didn't really have a name to sort of, get my foot in the door. So I was cold calling agents, trying to find somebody who would represent the book and help me shop it around. What ended up happening is, again, through a friend of a friend who was working for this publisher, which is based out of Massachusetts, he was in the acquisitions department, and he said, my friend told me about what you've been working on. It sounds pretty cool. I might want to, pitch it to my bosses if you're interested. And I kind of resisted that for a little bit because it felt like I was asking for a favor, or I wanted to try to like forge my own path a bit. But, you know, ultimately that's what I ended up doing.
So. That's the hard part. That's the introvert in you, right? Like,
exactly.
Like I'm imposing almost.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
What it was an opportunity. Right. And what I saw was almost like, oh, well, I know this person. It feels like a cheat.
Yeah.
But like when you're starting out with, you know, anything creative, whether you're a writer, an artist, whatever, like you got to find those angles. You got to find that way to get your foot in the door. So.
And criticisms?
Criticisms, yeah. You know, once the book came out, certainly I got a little bit of feedback. There was some people thought the sense of humor was a little juvenile. I remember one review compared it to the sitcom Two and a Half Men, which that one hurt. But, you know, but in the moment, it's very tough because you have put this, you've put all this work into this thing and you put it out in the world, and the reality is the world's going to let you know how they feel about it. Or not. I mean, it certainly didn't set the world on fire, but, you know, I had to be able to take the good and the bad. And in that moment, it stung, but after a while, you can kind of take yourself, you can put a little distance and you can look at it objectively and say, like, okay, maybe this critique is off base, but this definitely tracks. I see where this person's coming from. And the only thing you can do is learn and apply it to the next thing you make.
How did it go with your inner circle?
Fairly well, you know. I did share this with people as I was working on it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did you not trust them?
It's tricky, right? Because when your friend says, oh, this is good, it's like your mom telling you it's good.
Yeah.
And you have to, you can know sometimes which of your friends are comfortable enough to give you an honest opinion or, or piece of advice. And you know, a lot of people are like, yeah, this is great, keep going. And that's very encouraging, and that's important too. But, you know, certainly there was some objective and you know, some real feedback that I was getting from people. And yeah, that's important.
Interesting. Interesting. Anybody else? I'm wondering, oh, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm looking at this feedback on the back of your book. How did it feel to you to get feedback, like really good feedback from really big people all over the world?
That was really cool. Because, I mean, a lot of these people, like the guy who wrote the quote for the cover of the book was a writer and producer on Family Guy, and I just found him on Facebook. I kind of rolled the dice and said, well, you know, maybe this is the Alex Sulkin I'm looking for.
Right.
And he got back to me, and he was really sweet and wrote this great blurb for me. A lot of the people were like that. It was really just kind of reaching out and, again, putting yourself out there, and, you know, you really don't have anything to lose. Worst thing they're going to do is say no. But I was fortunate. A lot of people said yes and were very generous with their time.
And again, as an introvert, that's got to be like one of the toughest parts.
The hardest. Right?
Yeah.
The hardest, man.
Yeah.
So when writing this book, you obviously had to go back. So like when you were in your childhood, was that hard or easy for you?
Both, you know. I think, you know, the easy part was that I remembered a lot of it very clearly. The hard part was sort of figuring out, you know, because I am writing about not just my life, but there are other people who I'm writing about, real people who I knew. It was tricky trying to toe that line between how honest do I be about my own experience, how much of my experience was also their experience, how am I representing them here? And that was tricky. And I certainly heard from some folks who weren't pleased with what I did there, but, you know, I was... at the end of the day, what I knew I was doing was telling my story. I was being honest to that. And,
pardon the interruption.
You were also kind of naked, right? And exposed.
Yeah, very
much. Like, so there were some probably like hard truths that you had to share. I don't know how many of them got filtered out, but I remember reading it and thinking that there was definitely a vulnerability to you divulging certain information. You know what I mean? Even with the context of Star Wars to try to give it some light, you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, a lot of that stuff too happens sort of in my teen years when I'm the age that you guys all are. And that was when the prequels were coming out. And what I thought was an interesting hook for the book was that, you know, in my lifetime, I was introduced to Star Wars shortly after I moved to that new town and was struggling to find friends. And then every time the movies came out, it was sort of at this big, crucial kind of life milestone that a lot of people hit at those ages. So that's sort of the narrative line there. But yeah, that vulnerability was tough. Yeah. And I what I hope came across is that, you know, it's kind of warts and all. I showed, you know, some of the less appealing aspects of what kind of goes through a teenager's head.
Can you give us an example? Not everybody had a chance to read the book. Give us an example of a way that you took a childhood moment that didn't make you feel so great, and you gave it some Star Wars paint of coat.
Sure.
Coat of paint.
Yeah.
And you know, redirected it.
Sure. I mean, my introduction to Star Wars was, I was 7 or 8 years old in this new town. I remember one of the kids in the neighborhood knocked on my door. We went out, we were hanging out, and then all of a sudden I heard like rustling and screaming coming out of the woods, and all the other guys in the neighborhood run out with rocks and like balls of dirt and just start throwing them at us. And it was like an ambush. And then I go home and I'm, you know, covered in dirt and I'm upset. My mom's like, all right, I'm going to show you this cool movie. So she sits me down with The Empire Strikes Back. And it was, I mean, that sort of opened the floodgate. And it was this, you know, awful moment of like, I'm in this new town. I don't know anybody. Nobody likes me. And then I met this thing. And The Empire Strikes Back is the saddest Star Wars movie. And I was like, oh, the heroes don't always win. But yeah, like they get up at the end and they keep trying. And that was very, in that moment, that made me fall in love with Star Wars, but it was also this great life lesson that it's not always going to be great, but, you know, you have to keep trying. You can't really give up.
Empire Strikes Back has always been my favorite, but you just kind of gave me another perspective on why it clicks so much, why it's so important. Obviously, the good guys, so to speak, lose, right, mm-hmm. in that movie, or there's a lot of despair at the end of that movie. And that's the lens that I was always looking at it in. But now I'm looking at it like, man, what if I am on a losing streak, right? Like, what if my life is not going so well? And here's a movie that kind of sticks out and shows me that, yes, that happens, right? Like, this is a thing that happens. Even if it's a sci-fi fantasy movie, it's a thing that happens. But also, there's still that sliver of hope. What was your question?
My question was, when you struggled at one point in the book, did you go to any other writer for help or advice?
As I was writing it? Yeah, I actually had a really wonderful mentor from college who was a writer and an author who was very encouraging in class, and I stayed in touch with him after I graduated. You know, and kind of before I really started working on it was emailing him constantly, being like, oh, this is an idea I had. And he was giving me great feedback. If he thought an idea had no legs, he was like, you know what, don't spend too much time on that. It doesn't sound like you've really got a hook here. It doesn't sound like you're super passionate about it. But when I pitched him on this, he was like, this is what you should probably focus your energy on. And then from there, encouraging me as I worked on drafts and stuff. Cool. It's great to have those mentors, super important.
So the way how I see Star Wars back in the day is it wasn't as popular around. Now we have Star Wars like taking over the world. Mandalorian, when it comes out, is probably the best series.
Everybody fell
out
in
there.
Love with Baby Yoda.
Yeah, everybody fell in love with Baby Yoda. So how do you feel that Star Wars is like worldwide and that you're basically part of, you know, a reason why it's worldwide too? How do you feel about that? Because I love Star Wars.
That's a lot of credit.
I love
Star
Wars. Yeah.
I mean, you're sort of part of it. I mean, it's all around.
Because of this book, my best friend is a Wookiee.
That.
That's why we have Star Wars.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that.
George Lucas owes you so much.
Yeah. Other way around, definitely. But it's interesting because when I wrote this, and it's funny, it was like 10 years ago, if not to the day, certainly to the week that I handed over a draft for the last time to the publisher, like after revisions and edits and rewrites. So it's been a while. Even then, that was before Disney bought it. So I thought, okay, we have the 6 movies, the Clone Wars cartoon had started, but like that's it. Yeah. It was popular, but not like now. I didn't think this was going to happen. I think it's really cool. I have mixed feelings about the new movies, but I think Mandalorian is great.
We actually have a little bit of time. Please tell me about your mixed feelings, starting with the prequels, and go.
Oh, boy. You know, the prequels, they were a mixed bag, to say the least. You know, they were disappointing at the time. But what I'm seeing now is that people who grew up with the prequels as their introduction are kind of feeling the same way about the new movies in a lot of ways. By the end of the book, what I sort of realize and what I hope is sort of, because when I wrote this, we weren't talking about toxic fandom.
Right.
You know what I mean? What I realized, I had all this sort of anger about a thing I had no control of, a thing I didn't make, a thing that the creator did not owe me any, he didn't owe me anything. But a lot of Star Wars fans thought he did.
Right.
And what I realized is, oh, this is, you know, I'm seeing new kids falling in love with these characters and these worlds. And that's great. These are their movies now. And, you know, maybe maybe I'm at a point where I can put this sort of one-sided relationship in a different context.
I feel you, man. But when we talk about he didn't owe us anything. So George Lucas is the creator. This is his world, right? Like Stan Lee to much of the Marvel Universe, certainly Spider-Man. But when you talk about this is theirs now, right? Mm-hmm. There's a sense of ownership. Just like as kids, Star Wars was ours, right? Like
sure.
It was ours. Particularly if, and I was like, I had nerd jock duality, right? But particularly like for the nerd in me, right? Star Wars was mine, man. Don't mess with it too much. Don't mess it up. And that's why the little changes that started to, like, I didn't know it, but it was the canary in the coal mine, right? When we started seeing the changes in the re-releases, I started saying, all right, hold up. Like, how far are we going to go with this? I do want to ask you, I know we have more questions, but I do want to ask you while we're on the subject. Solo, where were you at with Solo, right? Like, Solo's a tough, it's tough because this. I found so much value in it, and I also left saying, man, that also could have been better. Where were you at with Solo?
On the whole, I liked Solo.
Mm-hmm.
I think there is, and it's not just with Star Wars, it's with anything. There's this sort of this tendency to be like, oh, we're going to do this little thing for the fans.
Mm.
And a lot of times that's misguided. We didn't need to know how he got his last name.
Right.
It seemed kind of silly. But, you know, I think for what it was, I mean, those characters are great. I didn't realize how much I had missed just Han Solo and Chewbacca doing their thing.
Yeah.
And seeing them together in, you know, adventures in their younger days, that was great.
Yeah.
You know, I could have done with a little less of the sort of unnecessary over-explaining of how things got to be where they're at.
Yeah.
Because it just gets in the way. I just want to see these characters that I know on an adventure.
Yeah.
And, you know, I thought a lot of that was really cool.
The Kessel Run, in my mind, was a much greater adventure and you know, than what it turned out to be in the movie. So, some of those things, maybe we don't need to see the magic explained sometimes. But I was definitely looking for a sequel. And I don't feel like... Also, by the way, you guys should know that the person who set out to make Solo, the person that was hired to be the director of Solo, there was some reactions. Somebody didn't like their version of what was happening on set of Solo. So that person left and they brought on a director who was more consistent, more famous, all of that stuff. But that person left to make what I think is probably the best movie of your generation, right? Like Enter the Spider-Verse. Y'all know Enter the Spider-verse? Miles Morales?
You bring this up every single time.
That movie is way too good.
If his thing is Star Wars,
it's way
my
too
thing
good.
Is Spider-Man. It, yeah.
It's really good, though.
But, so I want to know that director's version of Solo. Like, I want to know what didn't we get in the Solo movie? How much of that was his? Anyway, I'm sorry.
Bring him on the podcast.
I had to, of course, go back to Star Wars. I hear you. I'm going to go 1, 2, 3, go.
I have a question.
Oh, the hell, man.
It's Quinn.
It's Quinn.
Oh, Quinn. Hi, Quinn.
Hi.
Sorry.
So... a long-running feud between nerds and geeks.
Yeah.
And I might make you really mad because I'm on the other end from you. Star Wars versus Lord of the Rings.
How do you know you're on the other end from him? Because he wrote a book about Star Wars?
Yeah.
I didn't realize that was a thing. Because I definitely felt there was a...
Star Trek and Star Wars.
Yeah, that's why I thought he was going with this.
He said Lord of the Rings.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah.
That's
going to be for a loop.
I think...
You're going to be a good writer.
I think the Star Wars versus Star Trek thing is manufactured. You can love both.
Yep.
And I think, for me, I never thought there was a Star Wars versus Lord of the Rings thing. Mm-hmm. I felt, because the Lord of the Rings and Harry Potter movies sort of started at around the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And I definitely felt like, oh, I need to pick a side. I'm picking Lord of the Rings.
Yeah.
In hindsight, shouldn't have picked a side. They're both great.
Okay.
I don't know. They're so different.
Yeah.
But,
Because
I mean,
they're both kind of the landmarks of their genres, fantasy and science fiction. When you think of science fiction, you think of Star Wars, and fantasy, Harry Potter or Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, for sure. And even Star Wars bleeds really heavily into fantasy. Mm-hmm. I mean, a lot of like hardcore sci-fi folks would be like, "It's not sci-fi. It's you know, space opera. That's different. Fantasy in space." But
yeah, we're definitely gonna catch wedgies, right? Like, there's some of us nerding out here over Star Wars and Lord of the Rings. And
do you like Harry Potter? If you do, what's your favorite movie?
I do like Harry Potter. I think my favorite movie, I would probably pick Prisoner of Azkaban or Goblet of Fire. I think those are my two favorites.
Yes. Household.
Hmm?
Household.
Ooh, I'm not deep enough in that world to be able to pick.
But if you're deep enough into the world, you got to know that Harry Potter is not the hero, man. It's definitely Neville. Just FYI.
And like, you know, and that's what I appreciate.
Neville saves the
I read the books much later.
Yeah.
Certainly, like in my early 20s when I first started reading the Harry Potter books, and I appreciated that he's kind of a bratty kid sometimes. He's not the best student. He gets into trouble all the time.
A little snitch sometimes, maybe a little bit.
Yeah, you know, he's not.
He's imperfect.
Exactly, okay. Which makes him such a great character because you know those flawless heroes and those like capital E evil villains. Those are less interesting than characters that kind of exist in the middle and make you kind of think about.
Wait. So come back to Star Wars, right? Sure. And I got you. To come back to Star Wars, though, like. What really made it for me was that there were so many characters that were imperfect, right? Mm-hmm. There were so many characters that were like, are they a good guy or are they a bad guy? Yeah. They're kind of with the bad guys, but I like them so much. Obviously, Boba Fett, right? Like the Mandalorian who we all loved in my generation. Did you have your imperfect characters? Did you have your imperfect characters in Star Wars that you loved? Were you a Boba Fett guy, I think, is where I'm trying to go with it.
Fett's fire.
Oh, yeah. Boba Fett's super cool. I mean, what I kind of realized later is like, I like the way that character looks.
Yeah.
You know, because in the original trilogy, there wasn't a whole lot to hang your hat on as far as Boba Fett goes. He was just kind of standing there.
Yeah.
And then, you know, we got Jango Fett. Now we have the Mandalorian. We have a little context.
Yeah.
I mean, this is why the Han shot first argument is such a big argument that we're still having. Is because originally he did shoot first, and then by the end of the movie, he kind of has that redemptive arc. And by changing it so that, you know, Greedo is the aggressor there,
right?
It takes some of the ambiguity out of the character.
But that was part of what we love.
Exactly.
Right. But that's why coming back to the Solo thing, maybe don't show us some of the magic. Don't show us the Kessel Run because it was a mystery. At the end of The Mandalorian, spoiler alert, at the end of The Mandalorian, he takes his mask off, or somebody takes his mask off. And it was always a mystery. He could have been any one of us. That's why I loved Boba Fett, because he was such a mysterious character. It could be me underneath. It could be him underneath. It could be her underneath. That's why I love Snake Eyes. You know what I mean? Snake Eyes is like one of my favorite characters ever. I'm sorry. I'm taking up too much air because I love Star Wars. I want to remind everybody, don't forget that we are on a very popular podcast. I don't know why we're popular, because we make a lot of noise, but we're making a lot of noise now. So I just want to bring us back down.
Okay, so this is not only a question for Tony, it's for both of you, Roberto and Tony.
How the old guys in the room. Nice. Yeah.
How do you guys felt when you discovered the actual Star Wars timeline? That actual movie timeline?
What do you mean, in terms of like when everything happens?
No, like
or?
The first three movies were actually the fourth, fifth, and sixth.
Oh, I mean, that was part of the fun. Because. You know, before you knew that he was going to make the prequels, it's always like, what happened? Like, if he's telling us that we start at part four, there had to be three other stories. And just letting your imagination go and play with, you know, and that's where a lot of the pushback came from, is because for, you know, the 22 years, whatever, between A New Hope and The Phantom Menace, everybody made up their own version of what the Clone Wars were and where Anakin came from and what all these little clues actually meant.
Yeah, but like the prequels, like they satisfy both of you.
I think one of the things that he's trying to get at is it might be at that point impossible, because he could not have known when he started episode 4, A New Hope. He could not have known that it was going to be the biggest thing in the universe. He couldn't have known that. And when it became the biggest thing in the universe, and people did realize, wait. If this is episode 4, what is episode 1, 2, and 3? Then we romanticize and we fantasize about what episodes 1, 2, and 3 are. And we all have different versions of what that is. So by the time we get episodes 1, 2, and 3, it's not what we had pictured. Unless we all had pictured the same thing And he happened to go and film what we had all pictured in our mind, which we know is impossible because we're not a hive mind. Unless he did that, we know that it's impossible to give us all what we wanted. And he had, to that degree, probably an impossible task. And that's where I like what you said about he doesn't owe us anything. Go and tell me your story of episode 1, 2, and 3.
Yeah, and now you see the same thing happening again where there's a loud portion of fans who don't like The Last Jedi because that's not what they imagined Luke doing after Return of the Jedi. They thought he was going to do something else. They thought he was going to train a whole new legion of Jedi, and instead what they got is this sort of, you know, broken character having a crisis of faith.
Drinking milk from an alien teat, right? Like, that's yeah. a thing, like blue milk from a weird alien creature.
Yeah.
Did you have another one?
So if writing didn't work out for you, or you just like got stressed so much that you just gave up on it, what would be another hobby or job that you would like to do?
You didn't go that route, right? You didn't ultimately, you don't have a follow-up. You're not, you don't have a bunch of books. You have a very diverse career. You're working on, was it a little bit of radio? You definitely magazines?
Yeah, for a while I was an editor and writer for Providence Media. They published Providence Monthly, the yep. Bay Magazine, which happens over here. So yeah, I got into a bit of local journalism.
Covered. You have your own podcast?
I have my own podcast now. I started doing improv 3 years ago. Even after the book came out, I started taking classes at RISD's continuing ed program for video production. So I sort of, you know, I didn't really know what I wanted to do next because a few years after the book came out, the publisher said, you know, it's not selling well, we're ceasing publication, which is heartbreaking. But at the same time, I saw it as an opportunity. Like, okay, I've always liked film. Now I'm going to learn how, you know, the behind-the-scenes stuff. So I took classes at RISD. And then that got me into the job at the magazine. So I was doing some video stuff there, but then they recognized quickly that I could write, so they started giving me assignments. It's strange, you know? Life takes weird twists and turns sometimes, and the trick is to see a possible disappointment as a potential opportunity to try something new or to pivot. Improv. I wanted to do comedy as long as I can remember, and I finally just decided I'm going to try it now, and I've fallen in love with it. It's satisfying a lot of the creative impulses I have in a way that I didn't think I was ever going to as an introvert, and it's made me more of an extrovert. So,
do you get nervous?
Oh, I'm terrified right now. Yeah.
I don't know if you know, but the Cakes by Maureen, who was on a couple of weeks ago, when they got home, their clothes were soaked. Because they were super, like, you wouldn't know it, but they were super nervous.
She was so sweet, though.
But super nervous to be here on the podcast.
I didn't tell she was nervous.
She was sweet.
It's funny. And I would think, so introvert to introvert, what people don't know is to do something like this, or to put yourself in front of students, just like when you're on a stage, like, it's almost like there's a fake character, yeah. right? Like, this is, once I put on pants, because I like boxers, I like the couch, I like my Xbox.
You like Rocket
That's,
League?
Yeah, Rocket League is my jam. That's my jam. But once I put on pants, it's like I have to force myself to be a whole nother character to even leave the house.
You gotta be professional, Roberto.
Do you have, is there, like, Tony Plus, right? Like, is that Tony Plus mode?
Yeah, no, absolutely. There's definitely, like, the version of me at work. There's a version of me who steps out onto a stage and is, you know, super loud and super energetic and physical for 20 minutes when I do an improv show. And there's a version of me at home. It's like, I just want to, you know, I'm just going to grind Pokemon for a couple of hours and not talk to anybody.
Favorite Pokemon.
There we go.
Favorite Pokemon. What's your favorite Pokemon?
Oh, you know, I'm going to go Bulbasaur. Because that was...
You lost the crowd.
Never. No. You never forget your first Pokemon, man. That was that's where I'm at. That was,
Wait, I don't know Pokemon enough to know why Bulbasaur. Why is Bulbasaur?
I only know about
Bulbasaur and Charizard.
Because it's the weak one.
Wait,
Bulbasaur is the weak one of the.
Bulbasaur is the weak one of the bunch.
Bro, it's bro. I grew up a Charmander.
Charmander is the way.
But listen, my favorite Pokemon ever is Blaziken. I'm a huge Blaziken kind of guy.
I like Infernape.
I like Charizard.
Yeah, you're weird.
Infernape was my first ever start.
Blaziken was, no, as soon as I saw Blaziken, I fell in love. Blaziken is something
else. Wait, don't forget, one at a time. Who's your Pokemon?
My favorite one is the Charizard.
Oh. Is the Charizard. You have a Pokemon too? You have a favorite?
He said he doesn't know anything about Pokemon.
He knows Beyblade.
These guys didn't make it with me, but we took the Steambox podcast to Studio Ghibli to do an interview at Studio Ghibli.
Whoa.
And while we were there, we definitely went to like the Pokemon Center and stuff like that. And it was amazing. They have these hybrids, right? So they have like Pikachu dressed up at like so it's Pikachu in cosplay with like Charizard, you know what I mean? Like, it's super cute. It was super cute. Not gonna lie.
All right, so going back to Star Wars taking over the world, Star Wars is also really big in video games with Battlefront, Battlefront 2, and Jedi Fallen Order is probably one of the best written and just games I've seen. How do you feel about Star Wars game? I think so.
Okay, I'm asking this question.
So I played Battlefront when it came out, and it was kind of rocky at launch. I haven't touched it in probably a year or two.
I recommend it.
It sounds like they've done a ton of great stuff to it. Fallen Order looks good. Unfortunately, I just haven't had a ton of time to keep up with video games. I'm still catching up on my backlog, but I'm hoping to get to it.
Were you a gamer? Were you like growing up a gamer? Or?
I was never a hardcore gamer, but no. I was constantly playing video games. I mean, as far as Star Wars games go, I don't. For me, it's always like TIE Fighter is the best, but I clearly haven't played any Star Wars game in a while.
I would think that's before your time, man.
Huh? TIE Fighter?
Yeah.
No, it was early 90s.
Oh, I'm thinking arcade.
Oh, yeah, the PC game.
Yeah, okay.
All right. Fallen Order's good, though?
Yeah, it's good. The only thing about it is that once you complete the story, that's that.
Yes.
There's no online. Mm-hmm. It would be awesome, but
sure,
you can customize.
Oh wait! You're talking. I'm sorry. I was
talking about the newest game.
That was pretty good.
The newest game is
that was pretty good.
Is really really good.
He's right.
I recommend.
He's right. Even though you need a stupid PlayStation, he's right.
That's the only reason I turned on.
I got both. I have an Xbox and a PlayStation.
Wait, what do you got?
He has an Xbox.
Oh, that's.
I've got all of them because that's the only thing I splurge on. Right, like I'm. Poor, but I not poor with video games. I've got all of them, but
what do you think's better?
Oh, Xbox by far.
Xbox is trash.
Xbox is trash.
All right, So hold on a second.
The door.
So hold on a second. Hold on.
That way.
I don't know.
There's two options. Go through either one.
I know. We're talking about my best friend as a Wookiee, but I have friends, and I think it's a different generation. I think it would have been different. For Tony, and it would have been different for me back then because we can find people who are like us and playing the same games like us on the network. And I like the network that doesn't go down for 3 months. I'm just saying, that's Xbox. But so here's my question.
Okay, buddy.
It's a thing that happened. So here's my next question, right? This was a question that came up on the Alvarez podcast this week. The year 2050.
Yep.
Right? I'm going to start with one of my predictions. I'm going to ask you for your prediction. I'm going to let you guys chime in if you guys have predictions. But when we're talking about the year 2050, if we're alive, as a gamer, my prediction is in games. Yours doesn't have to be in games. It could be in anything. But I can tell you that right now, I think it's weird that people still buy discs and cartridges, right?
Yes.
When there's online stores.
I'm a steelbook kind of guy. If a game has a steelbook, I have to get it.
I understand. But I was a collector and I had a whole wall full of DVDs and games and stuff. And now it took me longer to get up and go and get the DVD than it takes me to find it. You know what I mean? Wherever I'm storing.
So every time I ask for a video game, because the only video games I'll ever ask for are Star Wars video games, I'll never ask for anything else. And every time I ask for it, I'll be like, oh yeah, can you just give me the, transfer the money onto my card, and I'll get it on the online store. My dad never listens. He just goes and gets the actual disc.
So you understand that digital is where it's at. So digital's where it's at. Like, I don't need to store it anywhere. I have it.
It
lives on the cloud, all of that stuff. But
can lose it,
but
you're done.
They're talking about, they just canceled E3. They're talking about E3 is the entertainment, electronic entertainment expo, right?
That got
right?
me so mad.
They were going to show the new Xbox. They were going to show, the PlayStation wasn't going to be there, but they was gonna.
True.
The developers were going to show stuff. So the new Xbox, I'm way off track, I'm sorry.
No, that's right.
The new Xbox, they're going to show the new Xbox, 12 teraflops. What does that mean? It means super powerful, but that also means the new PlayStation and Xbox are going to be super expensive because you don't need that. Consoles, we don't need consoles anymore because Xbox already has the X Cloud, right? A lot of people don't even know this thing exists, but what that means is on my Android phone, I can hook up a controller and I can play any of the games.
That's gonna be hard.
I can play any of the Xbox games through the cloud. Now, yeah, it's hard. You're looking on your phone or your tablet or whatever. But that's not the point, right? Like, if I have a Fire Stick, I don't need the Xbox anymore. I can put the Fire Stick into my TV, or some TVs already have Android on them.
Who wants a Stadia?
But then there's Stadia. Stadia's trash. Ew, but then there's Stadia. Stadia has their own platform, again, an app. And now GeForce, we were just talking about PC gaming. So now GeForce has their whole system on an app. We're a PlayStation away, right? We're a PlayStation away from everything being digital anyway. So what do I need your 12 teraflop Xbox for? I don't need it. Just give me the app and I'm good to go. That's my, hold up. So here's my question. I'm going to definitely come to you. I'll come to you. But in 2050, what I'm saying is you're not going to have an Xbox on your thing in 2050 unless you're nostalgic.
I probably will.
I mean, if you're nostalgic, yeah. Like, a lot of people went back and bought those retro Nintendos. Tony.
You saw me buy GameCube games when I was at, when we was at PAX. I bought a couple of GameCube
for games. For nostalgia, right? Like, so Tony, we've talked backwards, we've talked forwards, right? Backwards being like some Lord of the Rings, like archaic. And now we talked about future when there's X-Wings and all this stuff, even though it's a long time ago in a galaxy. Forget. So the year 2050... What should people expect that we're not thinking about right now? Are we finally going to have jetpacks?
Yeah. Ooh, no. What should people expect that they're not thinking about?
Yep.
Man, I don't even know where to start. It's, I think, you know, the way I was thinking about the future when I was a kid is so different from where we're at right now. Like, you know what I mean? I think technology did not develop the way I would have guessed. That I have any sort of reason or experience to suggest that I can guess where it was going.
Back to the Future promised us stuff.
But yeah, I've been flying cars, giant, you know, holograms. Well, I mean, they got the Cubs right.
Yeah. They were 1 year off.
That was unbelievable.
They were one year off.
But it was a joke. It was a joke, and to be 1 year off is amazing. And you could argue whether or not they were 1 year off going forward or backwards. Anyway, sorry.
I think what we're gonna see is, my wildest guess. I don't know.
Maybe the Super Bowl.
You know what? We're living in space stations. We will have orbiting sort of domiciles.
Okay, so not quite on Mars. But orbiting the Earth.
I think it's going to be a lot closer than Mars, yeah.
Okay, all right. We're going to be orbiting the Earth.
I might just be saying that because I just reread Neuromancer and that's what they were doing.
I like it, dude. I like it.
I'm going to go inside the video game.
Hold on.
Inside the console.
You want to be...
Inside the video
game. So you want, like, virtual reality.
Yeah, like it's not even virtual.
Oh, like Sword Art Online.
Like Sword Art Online.
Being in the game.
Like, being inside the game. Like, not even virtual reality.
Not your avatar.
No, it's me. I want to be on people.
Wait, why do you want to bust out a gun on somebody?
It's
called Call of Duty in real life.
It's called, yeah.
I mean, it can also be really dangerous because in the anime Sword Art Online, if you die in the game, you also die in real life.
Okay, but that's
is that still appealing to you?
The creator of the game wanted.
All right, but who knows if Trump can make that? Even though he's probably gonna be dead by.
But what Sylvia? But what Sylvia is saying? What Sylvia is saying? By 2050, they'll have sorted all that out. You say holograms?
Yes.
So, all right, we got holograms now, right? Like, Tupac is giving concerts and stuff like that, even though he's
Michael
dead.
Michael Jackson.
Tell me more about holograms in 2050.
I'm talking about, like, being in a room like this and having, like, a little projector in the middle of the room.
Yep.
And, like, let's say you're playing Call of Duty, and you have fake people and you have a fake gun, still making all the real sounds, still having all the real deaths, and all that.
Like the holodeck in Star Trek.
Exactly.
Like the holodeck in Star Trek. Go ahead.
So, growing up, I still am a comic book nerd. My favorite comic book.
Are you a comic book nerd?
It's been a while. Okay. A lot in
for sure. Yeah, this man was before my time, but I love Spawn. I was a Spawn kind of guy.
Todd McFarlane, Spawn.
Yeah, Keith David. Were you into like any of those heroes? Because I love Spawn. Shout out to Ed Boon, by the way. I love Spawn in Mortal Kombat 11.
I didn't read Spawn. There was a great comic when I was in high school called Powers, which was like a detective police procedural.
Yeah. He's my favorite.
But it was about the detectives who investigated crimes related to folks with superheroes, which was really cool.
It was a really bad TV show. I don't know if you saw it.
Yeah, it didn't stick around too long.
Yeah.
Grant Morrison's new X-Men was great.
Yep.
That stood out. Oh gosh, who was it? Who was? Oh, again, it was Brian Michael Bendis. His run on Daredevil in the early 2000s.
Yes. Daredevil,
killer.
Read anything Brian Michael Bendis. By the way, he's the one who invented Miles Morales from Enter the Spider-Verse, the Puerto Rican Spider-Man. I'm just saying.
Daredevil is probably my favorite Marvel hero. I feel he's really, really
the current underrated. Daredevil run is actually pretty good. I definitely still read because I have not left behind my nerd. It's just grown.
Mm-hmm.
It's just grown within me. So somebody actually called you Spider-Man at one point online. Do you know what I'm talking about? You did a charity for the Providence Community Libraries.
Yeah.
So why did somebody call you Spider-Man?
Oh, so this charity was they brought in this company to set up this rig and people could rappel down the side of a building. So
rappelling what's the game there where you Rainbow Six, right? Oh, like you're Rainbow rappelling Six. In like you're he's coming down.
That game is bad.
That game is
bad.
He did this in real life.
Yeah, so it wasn't. It wasn't a super tall building, but it was still a significant height, and they clip you in, and yeah, you just kind of drop over the edge, and you Spider-Man down. It was to raise money for the library.
Can everybody here, would you all be willing to rappel down a building?
Yes. I would just jump off the building.
You're scared of heights?
I'm afraid of heights, but you can bribe me, I'll do it.
I'm afraid of heights. Okay, so I got a couple people saying they're afraid of heights. Were you afraid of heights?
I was for a very long time, but I wanted to address that, so I started going to an indoor rock climbing gym.
Yep.
And getting comfortable with being, 20, 30 feet up, and then this charity came up, and the library is important, so I said, why not? And I clipped in, and it was fine until they stand you up on the edge, and you have to stare down and wait for the guy to tell you to go, and at that point, your legs turn to jello, and you second-guess all your decisions.
All right, so you didn't do it with ease.
No, it was not. Once you step over, it's and you feel how well the thing's holding you up. It's okay, but like that few minutes of just waiting on the edge is really it's kind of nerve wracking.
You talked earlier about having a writing mentor, Quinn. Do you have a mentor for writing? Do you have somebody that you could show your stuff with that you're comfortable with? I know your dad is an influence for you. Who else?
Yeah, I just read passages of my. Books that I like the most and just try to one of my favorite things to do is watching movies of and picking my favorite scenes and writing those scenes mm-hmm. as I would write them
okay.
and then like perfecting like what it would look like so that it matches the scene perfectly and that way I can visualize what's happening in my mind and write that scene based on that.
You ever make it better?
I try to, but because I pick my favorite scenes, there's nothing I can do better.
I did not know that about you. Yeah. I did not know that about you. That's very interesting. Thanks. I'm a pessimist. I'd look at it the other way, and I'd pick scenes that I don't like, because I do that all the time. I look at things that I don't like and say, you know what? They should have done this. In Solo, they should have done this.
Yeah.
I would have been happier if the guy died instead of the girl at this part. But you had a question.
Yeah. So I just recently finished my second novel, and this is one I'm kind of pretty proud of, and I want to try to get it published. What was the journey of getting your book published?
Sure. After I was comfortable with the work I put into the draft, what I did first was I tried reaching out to agents, literary agents, who would, represent you, shop the book around to publishers. That didn't pan out. But I was fortunate in that I had a friend of a friend who worked for the publisher who published my book. I don't know if I talked to him about it or if my friend had talked to him about it, but he said, this sounds interesting, and I think I could pitch this to my bosses if you'd like. And that's sort of how I got my foot in the door. But it is a lot of, trial and error. You're kind of cold calling people. Self-publishing is also significantly different and more accessible now than when I was doing things. That's also a very viable avenue, and I couldn't really speak to that, but I know there are a lot of resources, especially in Providence, through places like the What Cheer Writers Club have these sort of meetups and can direct you to resources. I think they recently had a panel about self-publishing.
Have you heard of What Cheer?
I went to like their opening
yep
once, and I've never been back, but yeah, it's a really cool place.
We're developing a relationship with them. I'll make sure to get you involved.
Oh, great.
We're also the What Chair, like, nursery farm and stuff like that too. Go ahead. Do you have any advice for somebody their age, particularly something that you would have done different, looking forward into whether it's writing or whatever they're about to move into?
Yeah, I think if you are interested in pursuing some sort of creative career or hobby or you know whatever your passion is, I think any opportunity to get involved with that as soon as possible. You know, if there's like a writing group or something through school, like my high school had a school newspaper and I wasn't involved with it, but that's experience. I did that in college and it was extremely beneficial. It taught me a lot about deadlines and editing and sort of getting that direct feedback and putting something out there. Anything you can do to put yourself out there earlier, I think is as important as doing the work of writing or creating itself. It teaches you discipline. And again, you're learning how to accept and cope with and contextualize real feedback that sometimes is not as positive as you might like it to be. When I was your age, a lot of the writing I was doing was kind of in a vacuum. It was just for me, or maybe it was for my friends, and that's good to a point, but putting it out there and it's important. It's a part of that skill set for being a writer that I didn't fully understand or appreciate at your age, and I wish I had.
Where can people find you? Where can people find your book? Where can people find other stuff that you're working on? Should people follow you on social media, and where?
On social media, you can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Tony Pacitti. There might be an underscore between my first and last name on one of the platforms. I can't remember which. The book is available on Amazon. Like I mentioned earlier, it's no longer in print, but I know there are copies floating around.
Do you mind plugging your podcast?
Oh, absolutely. I do a podcast called What Did We Miss? Where my co-host and I, we sit down and do a dive into pop culture that we are aware of but have not experienced ourselves. So if it's a movie we know about but haven't seen, book, music, that sort of thing. So sometimes it's something neither of us have experience. Sometimes it's something one of us really loves and the other one hasn't seen or read. That's What Did We Miss? That comes out every other week, and you can find that on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook at What Did We Miss? And I perform at Wage House, which is an improv theater in Pawtucket, a couple times a month.
Okay. Wage House, if you want to, like, go and make him nervous in the audience. Be like, remember me. We did a podcast together. Yeah.
And if you're interested in improv, they've started doing some teen workshops.
Yeah.
Which has been great, and I think their classes, I think 16 and up are what the classes are.
I have people in this room who have the energy, definitely. All right, so I'm going to ask you in just a moment if you have any shout-outs. So think about anybody that you would want to give a shout-out to. So right now, not 2050, 2020, right now you could have a book that's front and center of everybody's attention, and Oprah's going to push it and be like, you must read this. So what would it be? So it's not just what am I writing next, right? Because we can write things that we want to, but if you can have like one thing for the world, like what's your dream project?
That I would.
Yeah. Work. And is your dream project the book?
Wow. No, I don't know. I don't, it's funny. I spent some time writing a manuscript after this book came out, and I wasn't into it.
Yeah.
And I haven't really, I haven't thought about
That's
writing
important,
a book
right?
since.
Like, you gotta, yeah.
Yeah, I think doing it just to do it was kind of where I was at.
Yeah.
You know, the moment wasn't right. So, yeah, you know, I don't know that I have anything personally to say that I think the world should hear
Man,
about at the moment.
I want to write a G.I. Joe book where we look at fascism a little bit, right? I'm not saying G.I. Joe's the bad guys, but I'm also saying maybe we could take a look at Cobra being, maybe Cobra's not so wrong, right? Like, maybe Cobra is kind of like this this like revolutionary kind of movement. I know that people will hate it. I know that there'll be all kinds of nationalism. People will be like, what are you doing to my G.I. Joe? But that's like, if I could have one message for the world. Quinn, what's your dream project?
I don't know. I really like fantasy and just like, so, that's the book I just finished, but I really like horror, too.
Really?
Okay. Yeah. And like psychological horror, and I like writing like screenplays and stuff for that.
Are you into Stephen King?
Yeah. Yeah. And I don't know. Yeah, that's a really hard question.
I think I have an answer.
Okay.
And I would love to see something in the Star Wars universe that has the courage to not involve Jedi. Just completely strip it away from all the established stuff.
It's yeah.
They made this big sandbox and they keep going to the same place.
Yeah. The Force.
Yeah, or you know, it's like they don't trust us to believe there can be a Wookiee that isn't Chewbacca.
Yeah.
So I would like to just see more of that, or a Batman thing that you know, like I finally got around to seeing Joker.
Yeah.
And Bruce Wayne's in it.
Yeah.
We didn't need that.
Yeah.
You know, I just like these big universes that are so popular right now, superheroes, Star Wars, whatever.
That they could be independent.
Yeah. Make their, you know. Really, like, take it out of the comfort zone and show something new.
Okay, cool. I hope Sony's not listening, because I hear they're going to make, like, a Silver Sable movie, you know what I mean, and make it independent of, like, this whole thing. And I'm like, I don't know, man. This has been another Steambox podcast with Highlander. Can my Highlander homies and Tony Pacitti please say peace out?
Peace out.